Hello and welcome to your set unnamed London Theatre podcast for the 1st of July 2018. My name is T.R.P. Watson, and this time I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Phil from Western Rangers, and Paul in London. We're now going to talk about Fun Home at the Young Vic. This is a musical with music by Janine Tesori and a book and lyrics by Lisa Cron. It is based on the graphic novel by Alison Bechdel and is directed by Sam Gold. If you don't know who Alison Bechdel is from her graphic novels, you may recognise the name Bechdel from a thing called the Bechdel test, which indeed is something that featured in her comics. And it's the idea that to pass the Bechdel test, you have to have a film which features two named women who have a conversation, not about a man. Which is actually rather difficult. Some very interesting films featuring very powerful women often fail the Bechdel test. But in Fun Home, what we have is Alison Bechdel's biography, really about her coming out and discovering something of a family secret. John, tell me more about this musical and what you thought of it.
I did like it. I liked it a lot. And I think one of the reasons I liked it was I'm still suffering from missing Six Feet Under, you know, that wonderful American dark comedy set in a funeral home and showing that people who live in an undertaker's environment still have lives and humour and it's not all about death and gloom. But for me, I think The Young Vic has finally come of age. And I think Fun Home marks one of the best productions it's housed. I've seen some terrible musicals there, and I'm delighted to see Fun Home because it really does break new ground in format for musical theatre. So what it does is, just to confirm what you were saying about Alison Bechdel and her family, Fun Home charts the real-life steady progress towards coming out of she's a tomboy, later she's a very confident lesbian out cartoonist. And the event of her coming out coincides with the day that her long secretly gay funeral director father steps into the path of an oncoming truck. Now that's really brutal material, and even to put it into a graphic novel I think was an act of bravery by Alison Bechdel, but carrying it forward into a musical requires a very mature and very sophisticated treatment, and I think both the score and the script do rise to that occasion, and the work that Janine Tesori and Lisa Cron have done in collaboration flatters and enhances even the drama and intention of the original book. Also, this comes to us as a little transfer, it's more sort of distillation of the 2015 Broadway outing at Circle in the Square with the same director, Sam Gold. And I found the production really fluid and tender. It's beautifully lit. It's nicely designed because I think a lot of the scenery, if it wasn't actually shipped over, is replicated from the American production. I thought it proved the perfect framework for a shining cast. I can't overpraise Kaiser Hammerlund. I thought she was taut and observant and powerful as the adult Alison. I thought it was remarkable how I'd seen her first as a sort of skittish maid in A Little Night Music, the Hannah Waddingham version that started at the Chocolate Factory. And as different as it's possible to be in character and form and all that sort of thing, I thought she was remarkable. And then you have Eleanor Kane and a variety of girls, but on the night I saw a young girl called Brooke Haynes, just superbly sharing the role of their younger selves. They're called Medium Alison and Small Alison or something like that. And I thought Brooke Haynes is a star to be. But also that Eleanor Kane was equally on the brink of something to be celebrated. And the standout solo from the show is called I'm Changing My Major to Joan, or I'm Changing My Major to Sex with Joan, possibly. And it's the time when Alison has just become aware of her sexuality at university, has met her first girlfriend, and obviously her head is filled with all these sorts of thoughts. And I thought maybe it's just one highlight among so many in the show. And then you have the two sort of adult characters as a kind of still centre to the piece. You have Alison's mother, Jenna Russell, with the most demanding role, because her character is meant to not approve of this development and to be bitterly disappointed to find that somebody she's known for a long time, obviously that her husband has affairs with men outside of their marriage, but also that her daughter has chosen an alternative sexuality as well. And this is all contained for most of the show within a great cloak of regret and pain until she finally gets to release it in another powerful song called Days and Days. I don't know what to say about Zubin Vala, who plays the father, except it is an extraordinary performance, and he really does get the conflicts and the trickery and the deceptions and his finickiness. He maintains this very beautiful home that they've remodeled, and he's really fastidious about that. It's become almost like a museum or a mausoleum even. And, you know, his enthusiasms for every detail, from the sort of whittling of the woodwork to the positions of the cushions, it really is a very good gay man portrayal. But it's almost too uncomfortable to watch at some points. There's a scene where he takes the children to New York and they're kind of bedded down in somebody's spare, looks like a corridor really, but, you know, on sleeping bags on the floor of somebody's apartment. He wants to sneak out to a gay bar. It's really quite hard to watch. The other thing is, he's a bit hard to listen to. He is a very good performer, but I just find there's something curious about his voice that I didn't absolutely love. But all the songs grow from the narrative line. It's a pretty organically structured musical. So they don't fit the Broadway pattern of here's a ballad, here's a torch song, here's an anthem, let's stop and have some applause. And I think this complexity keeps you more engaged because the songs come out of the story surprising you and you listen to them because they really do move the narrative forward. So that was pretty good. There's a kind of story that says Fun Home is the first musical to feature a lesbian lead. I'm not sure that's true because I think Wicked and Colour Purple do have gay women characters. But nothing before this places them quite so fundamentally at the centre of the stage and the plot. And I think there's a lot of technical clarity and a lot of emotional truth about the way this musical does it. And then the other thing that I should say is that the stage of The Young Vic seems to have been extravagantly enlarged. I don't know what they've done. They built an extension. Because, first of all, the set is very generous. Anyway, it's very broad, and the auditorium is a nice conventional shape, and it feels like quite a big theatre. And then suddenly, you know, the whole of this home is revealed, which is like a further stage behind the stage we've been looking at for half an hour. It's really bizarre. I don't know how they managed it. So that's something really, really to admire. Oh, and I didn't mention three kids do a dance number on a coffin. I mean, I can't see anything not to love, but I know that Phil didn't enjoy it quite as much. So, Phil, what did you think of it?
Well, I kind of agree with some of the things you say, particularly about the staging. I mean, the stage did look enormous. And when there is the sort of the transformation, it was kind of like, oh, I didn't see that coming, which is, now we've spoiled it for everybody, we've told everybody about it. But also when they folded away, I didn't quite realise how they'd done it, because I was thinking I was looking at the back of the theatre, whereas I wasn't the real back of the theatre, because it's quite cleverly done. It's got a revolve, so that's in its favour. But you were saying about the uncomfortable moment when the father goes out and they wants to leave the kids behind. I mean, 15 minutes in, I wanted to leave the theatre, and we were sort of stuck on the end of a row, and it could easily have been a walkout had there been no interval. We looked at each other after the opening, which is hardly up there with, oh, what a beautiful morning as a Broadway musical opening.
Some Maple Avenue? Gosh.
I found the first 15 minutes excruciating, and it took a while for it to kick in, but gradually the story actually did kick in for me and it was the story that I enjoyed more than anything. And I do agree with you about the standout number, Changing My Major, performed by my favourite cast member in it, was the medium Alison, Eleanor Kane, who gets to do that number. And I think it's because it's the best number in the show anyway, by far for me. I found a lot of the music really saps on time. There's a scene where the father is teaching Alison to draw in kind of quite an aggressive way, and he sort of hums, and I thought, we're doing something in the part of George here. The number at the end, and since we've given away what happens when he either walks under a truck deliberately or not, is, I found that excruciating. Not excruciating, and I found it painful to watch. I just found the number that he was singing so dreary, so dull, that it lost me. The show lost me at that point of fun. And I felt there was probably a lot of people who had already seen the show on Broadway who were there. It's the same kind of feeling I had when I saw Avenue Q. I felt people knew it. And I think that perhaps, if you do know the music, perhaps it's better coming to it with some knowledge of it. Because I found it very unmemorable, very undistinctive. Indistinctive. The number on the coffin obviously wanted to do a big musical number, but I couldn't hear what the children were singing. They were sort of screeching. I thought they were quite often, I couldn't hear the children's voices in the numbers. They also do a sort of Partridge Family type parody, which I thought was just lame. It fell completely. I'm astonished by the 5-star reviews. I saw a completely different show, but I didn't hate it. I enjoyed some of it, and I particularly enjoyed the change in my major number, which actually began me thinking, oh, hang on a minute, this is really getting me now, because it was, I thought, a very cleverly done song. I agree with you about Zubin Vala's voice. I found him very strange. He had a very strange way of talking, which I found quite annoying. Jenna Russell, you'd either say it's an incredibly subtle performance, or she was underused. I felt she was sort of underused. I'm still reading reviews and thinking this is not the show that I saw. But I do feel at the moment I'm completely out of the critical consensus. I'm going to things which get 5-star reviews and I come out thinking, well, so what? So I can kind of take it or leave it.
We're now going to talk about One for Sorrow, which is upstairs at the Royal Court. This is a new play by Cordelia Lynn, directed by James MacDonald, with design by Laura Hopkins. It stars Kitty Archer, Pearl Chander, Neil Dudgeon, Irfan Chamji, and Sarah Woodward. The setup is that we are plunged into darkness, and we hear a voice which sounds like a phone call, but also might be an internal monologue, where a young man is saying that he is coming because he has been offered a place of refuge. And then we move into a house, possibly a suburban dinner, prosperous couple with their two young daughters, well, we only see one initially. This older daughter tells her family that she has offered a place of safety to people. What has happened, becomes clear, is an attack like the attack on the Bataclan Theatre in Paris a few years ago, where people opened their doors to just people who had been displaced and couldn't get home and needed somewhere to rest up and just be comfortable. And this is what the daughter has done. And there is a big argument about it. The parents want to be supportive and liberal, but they feel awkward. They don't want it to be them. They feel that it's a good thing to do, but they don't want it to be them who do it. And when the young man turns up, he is Asian, he's an engineering student or possibly a postgrad, and he is wearing a heavy coat and carrying a heavy backpack. And this is going to make people very uncomfortable. We then get really an investigation into everybody's different feelings of how this terrorist outbreak is going. We hear the growing death toll, the growing numbers of people getting killed. There, it looks like that there is a temporary siege on a place where there are a lot of people dancing. And it's clear that this young man was in the area at the time, and he behaves a little bit suspiciously, but also the family are just too uptight and nervous, especially the parents, who are possibly the most suspicious. They are a little bit too uptight and nervous about asking him who he is. The older daughter, it sometimes felt like a bit of a stereotype of the person who is basically wants the world to be nice to each other. The idea is that, you know, bad people should simply be hugged until they stop being bad. And she really is upset that the world isn't like that. But she doesn't want to accept that the world can't be like that. So she's very angry. And this is part of why she has invited this young man in. And we get an implication that she begins to be attracted by him and he's sort of attracted to her. Although we never entirely find out about him. He does reveal bits about his family, but we're always kept in suspense about whether or not he is guilty. And there's always the possibility that the older sister likes him because he is possibly a terrorist or possibly associated with the terrorism. The younger daughter is gleefully brutal. She is studying art at an advanced level, and she has created a small artwork which depicts the executions by IS. So she's a pretty scary, brutal thing. She's never really come up against the real world. She's lived in this rather privileged world where everybody has comfortable lefty sentiments. So in some ways, she feels almost in favour of the sort of things that the terrorists get up to. And she takes a brutal pleasure in it. But it's because she hasn't really encountered it. And as the evening goes on, she begins to encounter this. I thought this play worked really quite well. There's a lot of fading to black and having people's thoughts read out. sometimes the way that they use the language in this is artificial, but artificial in that it almost, I don't want to say Pinteresque, but it is a very deliberate, slightly obfuscating station in the way that people speak, so that we never quite get to the truth. There is an incident that kind of reveals the truth about the young man towards the end. But I did have a slight overall problem. I mean, a lot of the problems that the family have with this young man is that he refuses to take his big bulky coat off, and they think, well, maybe he's got something hidden underneath there, and they keep trying to politely ask him to, but he keeps saying he's cold and he's in shock and he doesn't want to. And it makes him very nervous, and you just think, well, why didn't you just say that you're being made nervous? Why aren't you coming out with it? And it's sort of that politeness. They don't want to actually tell the truth about how nervous they are and how unnerved they are. And yes, of course, it's racial profiling, and that is wrong, and it's racist, and that is wrong. But they can't help being nervous. And why can't they? And I kept thinking, well, why aren't they being honest? And why simply saying, okay, keep your coat on, just unzip it? So I was slightly aggravated by that. It's sort of keeps holding on to this idea that it may or may not be in part responsible for the terrorist attack. And I'm not sure it completely sustained it overall, but I did think this was very well acted, very nice performances, especially from Ifeoma Shamji and Harold Chanda, I thought. But sometimes my credulity was a little bit stretched by this. But overall, I thought it was a very good play. What did you think about it, John?
My thoughts about it changed in the kind of 24 to 48 hours after I saw it. And in fact, I think I'm quite lucky that I saw the first of two press nights and the reviews were embargoed until after the second one. So I did get some reflection time. When I first thought about it, or what I was thinking about it whilst I was watching it, perhaps, was it's really annoying. And I could see all the clunky flaws in it. Like, for example, you can always tell you're in a posh family house on stage because there's salad on the table with a meat meal. I didn't like the fact that in the title, One for Sorrow, there was a note from the PR team that the F in four must be capitalized. So I'm thinking, well, we're parked at Pretension Central right from the off. You know, what's that about? And I couldn't see anything in the play that referenced One for Sorrow that meant this extra word had to have a capital F at the beginning of it. So I thought it was nonsense, basically. But I did like the way that it was staged very firmly in, as you say, the smart home of urban liberals. And I thought that as Bill and Emma, the principal characters, Neil Dudgeon and Sarah Woodward, were just excellent. I mean, there's nothing Sarah Woodward does that I don't like, but she is just so perfectly that sort of thinking, adult, liberal, sophisticated woman that you might want to meet at a real live dinner party. And I quite liked the way the two daughters were drawn, even though they were too obviously bright and too furiously defensive. And then, again, you know, Emma, the Sarah Woodward character, it's a bit of a cliche if she works in human rights legislation. And then either from authorial laziness or a means to downplay his patriarchal role, Bill's career isn't defined. So that's a bit uneven-handed, isn't it? If she's very keen to point out what the wife does for a living, but won't mention what the husband does. And then they both drink a lot of white wine on a weeknight, which is Royal Court Young Writers Scheme shorthand for self-indulgent rich folks. But I did think Cordelia Lynn has a really clear, almost a musician's ear for domestic badinage. And the first act could be Mike Lee, if it weren't for the fact that the drama down the road is marginally more upsetting than Abigail's party, because as you said, Tim, a Bataclan type attack. As it's not just the events of a Bataclan type attack, I think, in this case. I think it has escalated beyond that into full-scale mayhem, and the city is in full-on riot mode as the body count climbs. I think they get to about 500 people, which is far more than were affected by the Bataclan incident. When the young man arrives with his heavy parka and his bulging backpack, like the parents, I jumped to the conclusions everybody would consider. And I was cross that the Snapchat radicalized daughters didn't get the obvious significance of that and that they still champion openness and inclusion and snogging him. But it is a clever concept, fighting against the fact that although the dialogue is very well written, the agenda is clunkingly obvious from about page two. You know, you said it, we should just hug everyone of any differing values of opinion. We shouldn't call urban bombing of civilians terrorism. I'm about 200 years too old for that sort of debate, but the opening night audience took it very well. Cordelia Lynn says she's exploring fear culture, which I didn't really know was a thing, and I had to look it up, but apparently it's what fuels any resistance to letting teenagers make government policy. But again, my reflection on the play gave me a better opinion towards it after it had sunk in and a day or so had gone by, and I think that from that feeling you get, that sense you get of being manipulated, of being fed misinformation, and the very fact that your reactions to all of what happens are inconclusive, means the play has made its point. And I thought the whole cast was impressive and naturalistic and very consistent in tone, you know, from, as I say, Sarah Woodward, who I think is always watchable, right through to absolute newcomer Kitty Archer, sort of straight out of RADA as Chloe. And that naturalism is a neat touch, and I like James McDonald's direction that just kept that going, even through areas of the script which are deliberately absurdist. You know, there are hints of M.F. Simpson in some of the things the family says to each other. It's really quite interesting. So for all my scepticism about the political views expressed by some of the characters, I do think this is impressive work from a playwright to be taken seriously. And that it's only very slightly too long and very slightly too under-resolved. I sort of hope she takes a fresh look at the script in a couple of years and maybe reattaches it to some other incident that may or may not have happened by then. Perhaps a slightly more distant perspective from all the recent outrages would make it even more impactful.
We're now going to talk about The Secret Lives of Baba Seghi's Wives by Lola Shonyin. It's directed by Femi Eleofaoju Jr. at the Arcola Theatre, and it is presented by the Eleofaoju Jr. Ensemble. Baba Seghi is a successful Nigerian merchant. He has three wives and seven children, but there's a slight secret behind that. Paul, tell me more about this play and what you thought about it.
Actually, I had no idea what to expect when I went to see it on the press night, because it's 2 hours straight through without an interval, and you think, this will be interesting. But, you know, the Arcola has a reputation for doing excellent productions and, you know, theatre and giving you different perspectives. And, you know, one of the things attached to the poster is, men are like yam, you cut them how you like. So it's like, okay, this is even more fascinating. But actually, what then plays out in front of you over the next 2 hours is an extraordinarily frank and candid depiction about the lives of these women who live in a polygamous relationship in Nigeria. And essentially, you know, the characters talk to the audience, they throw props at them, they emerge from the audience, and they give fairly detailed and frank descriptions of sex practice and gender dynamics. It all comes out right and very funny in front of your eyes. And it's incredibly funny as well. But, you know, behind all this is some very clever storytelling in this adaptation for the stage. So there was a book this was based on. It was actually discovered by the director, according to the program. It was discovered by the director in the secondhand book market under Waterloo Bridge a few years back. And the director worked with Rotimi Babatunde to actually adapt it. And then his particular company has sort of workshopped this. And what's incredible about it is that actually, while there's a lot of narrative happening and the characters narrate the story, it just feels so fresh and so lively. And also what's clever about it is how it can shift from what can be quite disturbing scenes to completely over-the-top comedy, just without skipping a beat. I think Baba Seghi, who's played by Patrice Nyambana, he really looms large over the piece as this rich businessman. But he's also presented as sort of the comic buffoon in the piece. And particularly as the secret is revealed later on, which I won't do because it is too significant of a plot device to reveal in any review. It's just an incredibly clever piece. And also by making him the buffoon, it makes him a little bit more likable, even if he's doing particularly unpleasant things. But essentially the story's premised, he's got three wives and he wants to take a fourth. And the fourth wife seems to be a wife that is one that he wants for himself, because the first three were given to him for economic circumstances. So the first was because his mother was friends with the wife's mother, and the second was to pay a debt. The third was to escape, you know, financial hardship, so she sought him out. But the fourth one, this was one that he wanted for himself. But what that set in motion was essentially his downfall. And so it's an interesting thing that actually plays out. And what it also gives you, a window into is sort of both the old world and new world culture clash in modern Nigeria, which you wouldn't normally get a chance to see. And there's a lot of lively music and a few simple props, but all the cast, you know, come together and they actually play multiple characters and really give this a piece of fluent storytelling. And it's an incredibly funny ride. And, you know, in one of the highlight pieces where Babu Segi has to give a sperm sample, it's elevated to this ritual of such epic proportions, and it keeps going on that, you know, once you finish, you know, picking your jaw off from the floor, you just can't help but be in hysterics watching it. And it was, if you watch any of the audience members during this piece, you know, they go from shock and awe to absolute hysterics, and their transformation is quite funny just to watch the audience reaction in many of these scenes. Having said that, the cast, you know, work really well together. It's this combination of music, performance, you know, just storytelling to, you know, give a very interesting take on life. And I think it's well worth seeing. Hopefully it'll get picked up and return somewhere else because it's got tremendous reviews. Tim, did you agree?
I certainly wasn't expecting to enjoy it as much as I did. It's one of those things where I thought I ought to book for it because I was booking for lots of other things at the Arcola at the time. And I thought, well, why not? And I was surprised by it. I mean, it's a look into lives that you're not entirely sure of because of this polygamy thing, which is usually treated as a rather difficult thing, but it's not treated as a difficulty here at all. It's completely natural and everybody understands what's going on, and the women are going into it with their eyes open. So they don't seem to mind at all. And yes, you kind of, I have to say, I kind of worked out the twist that we discover at the end well before the moment, in fact, they had to go for fertility treatment. I knew pretty much what the outcome was likely to be. But it's certainly done in an extremely entertaining way and very clever way. And it's always a, you know, sort of a delight to see people who try to involve everybody. I mean, although it is always a little bit scary when you hope you're not the person who's going to be picked on. Not that they do that much in this, but there is moderate audience interaction and looking around and trying to get people's attention. So that works extremely well, but I'm a bit nervous about that. I'm always a little bit nervous about that sort of thing. But yeah, it's really well done. It tells a very, very entertaining story. In some ways, a touching story. Certainly, the history of some of the women in there is fairly tragic, and you see that the way that women are treated in Nigeria. Actually, they did a survey, and it's one of the top 10 worst places for women, according to one survey that came out recently, which is not too nice, but this is the way that women sort of gain protection by going into these polygamous marriages, which I found really interesting. But as I said, it's not something that's treated as bad, or nobody thinks of him as a terrible person for doing it. And yeah, they do seem to have basically a pretty good relationship with each other, although obviously there are various tensions that we begin to see that come out of this and that come out of the wife's apparent infertility. But overall, yeah, it's great fun. It's an unexpected pleasure, really, because you maybe didn't think that it would be, but it's one of those things where you say, oh, right, good, yes. And this is why we should go to theatre and why we should take risks with theatre and not just go for, you know, the characters, people you know, and you know, things that you already know. When you see something that you think, well, why would I want to go and see that? Well, try it, and you may find that you like it a lot, and certainly that was the case here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think Lola Shonayan, who wrote the book, has also written for The Guardian. And you see in her writing some of the ridicule, but also some of the seriousness she also highlights about this issue in modern day Nigeria. And that is all brought into frame in this dramatic narrative. So, you know, it's a careful balance, I think, between the humour, but also some of the serious issues that they want to point out. And I think using comedy to actually point out some of the stranger customs and habits of one segment of Nigerian community is quite interesting and quite a, you know, powerful theatrical device to use.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.